Blog Talk Radio.
Mother, help me. Mother, heal me. Please release me from all things worldly that do not serve me.
What, 3 minutes?
Mother, love me. Mother, help me. Mother, heal me. Please release me from all things worldly that do not serve me. Mother,
and welcome to Main Street Universe, the show reminding you that the mysteries and possibilities of the universe are closer to Main Street than you may have ever imagined. And I don't know about you, but I can imagine a lot. Remember that every episode is recorded in our archive section. What does this mean? This means that next week you can listen to last week this week. In our archive section right there at Main Street Universe, our website, or our main Blog Talk Radio page. And I would like to start off, my cat seems like she wants to join us today. In the beginning, he sometimes does. Indefinable, yet continually present. It is nothing at all. It is the formless form, the imageless image. It can be grasped by imagination. It has no beginning, no end. This is the essence of Tao. Stay in harmony with this ancient presence, and you will know the fullness of each present moment. Today our guest is Mark Sutton. He's written a book called Heart Healthy Pizza. It is a book full of vegan pizza recipes, and I just had the pleasure of trying one for the first time, and we'll share that with you in a moment. First, let's start with this. Pizza. There are few foods that conjure up as much interest, emotional attachment, and enjoyment as pizza. In the United States, it's the second favorite takeout food behind chicken. An estimated 3 billion pizzas are processed each year. Surprisingly, or not surprisingly, a recent Gallup poll notes that children between the ages of 3 and 11 prefer pizza over all other foods for lunch and dinner. Unfortunately, there is a downside to conventional pizza. The preponderance of cured or uncured meats and various cheeses on the average pizza can be a nutritional nightmare for many reasons, mostly related to the amount of fat and saturated fat in both meat and dairy products. Traditional nutritionalists will advise minimizing the amount of meat toppings, using lower fat or smaller amounts of cheese, and incorporating more vegetables when ordering or making pizzas. Although these recommendations may lessen the potential negative biological impact to one's body, they are by no means true safeguards against many degenerative diseases stemming from dietary abuse, including those of obesity, heart disease, some cancers, and type 2 diabetes. It's not just the meat and or cheese that is helping to enable heart disease. It is the added oil. Over 20 years of independent peer-reviewed research by doctors Dean Ornish and Caldwell Esselstein has demonstrated that a no added oil plant-based diet, I'll say that again, no added oil plant-based diet can not only reverse heart disease, but in theory, prevent it. Furthermore, studies by Dr. Neil Barnard have indicated that the same diet can reverse type 2 diabetes, and the writings of Dr. McDougall point out how added vegetable oils are easily oxidized, forming free radicals that damage the arteries. A truly heart-healthy pizza would not contain any oil or fat. Unfortunately, the current generation of non-dairy cheeses, quite remarkable in their gooiness and melting capabilities, are often as high or higher as their dairy equivalents in unhealthy added fat or oil. Additionally, most are very expensive and provide little in the way of useful nutrition. That's the introduction, or part of the introduction, of the book that we'll be focusing on today, as well as other aspects surrounding the book. The author is Mark Sutton. The book is Heart Healthy Pizza, over 100 plant-based recipes for the most nutritious pizza in the world. So right now, without any further ado, I would like to welcome our guest, Mr. Mark Sutton.
Hi, Daniel.
How are you this evening?
Doing pretty good. Just had a slice of pizza.
Yes, and it was quite good. I truly enjoyed it.
So you had your first vegan pizza. What did you think of it?
Absolutely. The one that you brought over was definitely as advertised in my conversations with you and as well as in the book. Its texture was completely satisfying to it being possibly cheese or being a substitute for cheese.
Or cheese-like.
Cheese-like, and honestly, I found it to be far superior than, say, soy cheese, which I'm not a big fan of.
Cool.
Soy cheese. Soy sausages I've had, and had some this week, that are actually, there's some that are quite good, but those soy cheeses, this was far superior, and I like the way you spiced it up. Describe the one that we ate.
Yeah, the cheese-like topping sauce had oats, cannellini beans, sriracha sauce, which is a chili garlic sauce, nutritional yeast, some cornstarch, and about a quarter of a cup of cashews. It's a one-pound pizza. And water. The pizza itself was Trader Joe's basil crust, which is really convenient to use. Broccoli, fresh mushrooms, green, red, yellow peppers, onions, capers, pepper, chili peppers, flakes, Italian seasonings, ground pepper, and on top of the sauce itself, sprinkles of paprika.
Ah.
And I went with the cannelloni bean recipe because I know you're a carnivore, and so you've got more texture with the beans.
Yes.
And the cashews, which I use minimally on some of the recipes, some nuts, give it a little more of a fat texture with minimal fat. There's a little bit in there, but spread out across an entire pizza, which we're splitting, is not a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
So it's one of my favorite recipes. It's pretty easy to make. The sauce is made in a blender or a food processor. In this case, it was a blender. Poured on top of the prepared pizza. We'll post pictures later. And then it's baked as you would normally bake a pizza. My goal was to make these recipes as simple, inexpensive, and easy to prepare as possible. I don't like to waste time in the kitchen. I'm more interested in the final results, as most people would be. And it gives you more time to have a glass of wine when you're waiting for your pie.
And that brings me to another point. You mentioned what you like to do and how you like to save time. Let's do a little bit of background. You were, amongst other things, a gourmet chef.
Well, I'd like to think I am. I mean, it's not a professional title.
Right.
I haven't gone to any school, but I've been cooking vegetarian for probably and vegan for about 35 years now, which I think puts me into the competent amateur category, maybe even crossing into the low-end professional gourmet cook.
Hmm.
And it's been a thrill. Originally, it was a challenge 30, 35 years ago, but now with all the books that are out, the beauty of having the internet to interact with people, to find recipes, to exchange ideas and techniques and ask questions, cooking vegetarian, and particularly vegan, is extremely easy. It's just not that difficult, whereas it used to be a real challenge. Used to walk 15 miles to the snow to get yellow tofu at a Korean market, you know. Then Tofutti came out, I guess about 25 years ago, and tofu started showing up in stores, and you could actually buy it. But for a while, there wasn't even tofu. And a lot of you people out there that are younger than myself, significantly younger, have probably never been through a period where there's no tofu around.
Yeah.
Not that that's all we eat, but it's a good example.
Yes, and I remember I've dated a few girls that are vegetarians. I've been back and forth with it myself, doing it here and there. And definitely just in my lifetime, being 41, in the 1980s, let's use that as an example,
okay.
Late 80s, I was vegetarian for a while. Very difficult when you went to a restaurant to find. You could find something, but it wasn't anything fun. You know what I mean? Or it wasn't anything with sort of the sensual satisfaction, especially of like what we just had, something of that level. It was maybe, okay, you got this little small, you know, chef salad, but hold the hard-boiled egg or whatever. It wasn't really. It was harder to get interesting things.
It used to be very, very radical to be vegetarian. 30 years. I was vegetarian for 20 years, and I've been vegan for 10, low-fat, no added oil vegan now for about 5. Which means I don't use any oil at all. And originally, being vegetarian was very radical, just like yoga was in the early 80s. Now, people very rarely blink an eye when you say you're a vegetarian. You say you're a vegan, the people who are 30 and younger generally know it already.
Yeah.
People over 30 might be a little puzzled by that, but it's very easy to go vegetarian in restaurants these days. Being vegan, it's a little tougher. Not impossible, although I wouldn't walk into a restaurant on a Friday or Saturday night when it's busy and say, hey, I'm vegan, what can you do for me? That's kind of like, you know, really, really, I think, a bit rude to the establishment. I recommend actually calling the restaurant or going online and seeing if you can find their menu first and beforehand and do a little research and see, you know, what can be done. It's doable. The trick is to be pleasant about it because it's still new. A lot of people have a tough time with the idea of no cheese, which is one of the reasons I wrote this book, because it's the issue of cheese that keeps so many vegetarians from going vegan. And cheese is inherently an unhealthy substance, which we'll probably cover at some point, or so I believe. But one of the reasons I wrote the book, I set out to write it, was to help vegetarians realize that there are alternatives to cheese, particularly for pizza, which I dearly love, having worked in a few pizza parlors when I was younger.
And just for a moment, and then we'll get into some other aspects
sure.
of this, but since we just started out and we talked about us trying it and eating it and you're giving a little bit of background and a little bit of background of vegan and vegetarian, I also want to put out a disclaimer out there. Not a disclaimer, but a statement. Some people actually get upset. We had talked about this in private, about how diet can be very controversial sometimes.
Oh, yeah.
And people can actually, they kind of go, oh, you're preaching your veganism on me.
Yeah, let's talk religion and politics while we're at it, too.
Yeah, almost like it's the same thing. And it's not always necessarily the same thing. All we're doing here on today's show is giving you the information And you make your decisions accordingly.
I think that's a very important statement, Daniel. Let me elaborate on it. We're not making any recommendations. In my book, I'm saying this is what I have found out. This is what I do. Here's what you can do. But I recommend that anybody going a vegetarian or a vegan or any kind of, we'll say, non-mainstream diet, do their homework. Do your research. Find out. If you want to talk to your health provider, great. Although a lot of them tend to be very conventional in their viewpoints. The important thing is we are not recommending that you go this route, but we're providing information and ideas and thoughts and maybe some rationalizations as to at least why I believe this is the way to go. And the final analysis, you have to learn to trust your body. Your body will tell you what works for you if you're listening properly. And that's what I try to tell people. If it works for you, go with it. Many people have said, would I go back to eating meat or eating dairy or eating eggs? And I simply say, no, it works for me. In 30 years, I've had to see a doctor twice, once recently because of a severe leg injury, and once for a dermatologist for rosacea, which got cleared up. So for me, it works. I find that I thrive on a vegan diet. And, you know, there are reasons that are beyond just health for going vegan, depending upon who you talk to as well. And we may touch on that later in this interview.
And I wanted to jump, and we'll come back to this and then continue our philosophical conversation.
It's all philosophy, Daniel.
Sure. Right now, and since we did just try something, I'd like to just breeze over a couple of these sauces. It's the sauces that are sort of the money in this. He creates, Mark creates, and I just had one, and I can attest to it, these very thick sauces out of different grains, beans, legumes, all that sort of stuff, and they come out very thick, thicker than I thought it was going to. I thought it was still going to taste very good. I was surprised at the texture, at the cheese-like texture. And let me give the names of just a couple of these.
Okay.
I thought some of them just sounded fascinating. One of them said barley cauliflower vermouth. That was kind of interesting.
Yeah, the vermouth was one of those nights.
Were you just drinking the vermouth and put it there? No.
Hey, let's try some vermouth, okay.
That's right. There's millet avocado and oregano. I love avocado.
That was an error. Let me comment on these as you do them, okay?
Sure, yeah.
That was a particularly arrogant one, so I went, I wonder if I can, I mean, avocado's thick. I wonder if I love millet and quinoa, or quinoa, if you want to pronounce it wrong.
Sure.
And I thought, what an arrogant idea. Could I put avocado in sauce? Why not? It's just a looser guacamole of sorts.
Yeah.
The trick with that one was to add a little lemon juice so that the color stayed a light greenish, and it made for a delicious sauce. One of the favorite recipes is I like to put that on a pinto bean-based pizza to get kind of a southwestern pizza kind of thing going with the avocado and the millet on top.
Another one. I'll do one more, and then we'll kind of move on.
Feel free. This is kind of fun. I don't get to talk about them that often.
Yeah, we'll bookend this. You see, I want to start out with it being fun and food.
Okay.
This is how I'm bookending it. Then a little bit of philosophy and seriousness and bantering about those things, and then back to fun and food at the end.
Oh, banter. Okay, he didn't tell me you wanted banter.
I have a feeling you can handle that. But there's another one here, millet, cashews, and mustard sauce, which sounded...
Yeah, that was one of the very first ones. I do want to get into later why I went no oil on these pizza toppings, if you will, because I didn't start out with that in mind when I started to work on the recipes for this book. But the millet cashew was one of my very first. I had learned how to make millet sauces using what's called the soy toy, soy milk maker, and discovered I can make very velvety millet sauces, normal sauces for grains and for legumes and pasta. And I reasoned that, hey, I'll bet I could thicken that up, add some cashew nuts, and make a sauce that would go on top of a pizza. And I'd seen cashew butter-based sauces before used in different places, but people tended to use a half cup to a full cup of cashews, which... you know, in regards to where I eventually went with this book, was just not going to happen with the amount of fat that's in cashews. But the millet cashew recipe was one of my very first very basic, very simple. It's a good starter recipe for people who are still trying to get over cheese, which is a taste addiction in many ways. We'll probably discuss taste addiction at some point.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a good starter recipe, and it has a very nice, the millet imparts a very nice velvety texture, while the cashews give a little more of a fat-like oomph to the sauce itself. The sauces range from a velvety-like texture, depending upon the grains and the ingredients, and not all have grains in them. Some are just pure vegetables. And then others have a custard-like texture, again, depending upon the ingredients. Sunflower seeds are particularly useful to get a custard-like, very delicate custard-like effect. Really kind of nice.
Another one.
I do say so myself.
Oh, yeah. It's very interesting. And trying one, which I'm really glad you brought one over. I know, you know, everybody's busy and we were pressed for time and we weren't really sure. But I was really glad you decided to take the time and make one. And then you had to transport it all the way over here and slip it and slide it in your car, right?
Well, I'm staying at my house, sitting in my parents' house in Fairfax, Virginia for the summer. And thank God they don't see the kitchen right now after trying to knock this thing off before I came over. It'll be clean by the time they get back.
Sure.
Later in the summer, hopefully.
And if my brother and his wife are listening, their kitchen should be clean by the time they get back tomorrow night. There's another one. And then we'll move on from
here.
This one, because it just caught my eye. Millet, black-eyed peas, and ginger. And you know I love ginger.
Exactly. Yeah, that was one of those. Some recipes you just suddenly pop into your head. Some are calculated. I've always liked black-eyed peas. I lived in Alabama for a while, spent several years living in Texas, learned to love black-eyed peas and greens and Hoppin' John. It's a classic dish for New Year's Eve in the South. And I decided, you know, could I make a sauce with black-eyed peas? Because I was thinking of okra and jambalaya and a more southern Creole Cajun type of a pizza itself.
Mm-hmm.
In the book, it's not just sauces. I have several recommendations and examples of pizzas where I say, okay, you know, this one has okra, this one has eggplant and different vegetables. There's a variety of different types of pizzas, not just sauces, to put on top of them. And the black-eyed pea was clearly destined for something from the South, no doubt about it, especially with Tabasco sauce.
Yes, and the ginger element. I found that to be interesting because I love ginger. Were you trying to take that? I didn't read the whole recipe for that particular pizza. Were you taking it in a slightly Asian direction?
That was just something that I thought would be an interesting kick with the black-eyed peas. I don't know really where that came from. It's just like ginger is a wonderful, wonderful root.
Yes.
One of the three sacred bulbs, onions, garlic, and ginger. Some would say galanja as well from India. And it just seemed to me that it would add a nice kick. I think I actually might use it occasionally when I do something, make a black-eyed pea stew. But for some reason, ginger was on my mind that day. I'd have to go back to my notes and figure out what I'd been working on that week. Because oftentimes one recipe leads to, hey, that was an interesting element. Let's take that element and try it over here. These recipes took almost 6 years to develop.
Oh, okay.
A lot of experiments, a lot of notes. I had people helping me test these out. Sometimes it would take 5 or 6 times to get a recipe correct, although now I haven't gone to my book that often recently. I find that after having done it so often, I can pretty much just knock one off. And I'm hoping that most people, as they use the book, get to the point, too, where they can look at what they have in the kitchen and basically figure out a sauce very quickly. The more you use these recipes, the more you get towards that point where you can improvise.
And I want to talk a little bit about the grains, and without saying all of them or everything, what Mark uses to make his thick, heavy sauce. One of them is millet, and I'll read from here a little bit. Millet, admittedly, is a favorite for making these sauces, incredibly nutritious, the most alkaline of the grains. That fact interested me because of the idea of alkalinity versus acidity. It's a real powerhouse. So maybe a word or two on millet.
Yeah, the grains were chosen deliberately. I wanted diversity in grains.
Biblical millet, right? Biblical grain.
Well, we'll get to that.
Yeah.
It's also used. We use it as bird feed more here in this country than we do eating it, but that's another story. I wanted the diversity in grains because we're hooked way too much on wheat and to a secondary degree rice in this country, particularly white rice. And I find that, for me, a diversity in terms of all my food intake is very healthy, and I want to diversify my grains. Millet's a fantastic grain. It's very inexpensive, usually $1 a pound for organic millet, depending on where you get it. Cooks in 15, 20 minutes, marvelous nutritional profile. I think the only grain that matches millet in terms of just being fascinated by it is quinoa, or Q-U-I-N-O-A.
Mm-hmm.
I know there's a bunch of people who were thinking of listening to this broadcast who are on a quinoa list. And quinoa is a South American grain that's extremely delicate, but very, very nice to use. Takes about 20 minutes of cooking time as well. Barley was used deliberately because I'd made mushroom barley soups and stews many, many times, and barley has a thickening quality. Anybody who makes a barley mushroom stew or soup will know the next day in the fridge, invariably it's thickened up because of the barley. And so barley became a natural in terms of, well, I should be able to make some interesting cheese-like sauces using barley. The downside of barley is it takes a little more cooking time. I use pearl barley and not the unhulled barley. Of course, I use rice in these recipes, brown rice preferably. A lot of the recipes, when I made them, I don't really bring this up in the book, were from leftover grains in the refrigerator, where I always make extra grain when I make a grain so that I can do something with it the next day or the next day or two. So I had an extra cup of millet or a cup of rice. I didn't get a chance to use buckwheat, which I think would have been fascinating. It's such a heavy grain in taste, a European grain, but buckwheat would be very interesting. I do use corn, which technically is not a grain. Millet and quinoa are not grains. Technically, they're seeds, but we won't tell anybody. I did mess around with whole wheat. I did do some raw gluten-free crust and some raw crust with sprouted wheat and sprouted rye, which did not make the final cut for the book. There are some gluten-free recipes, by the way, and several in the book in terms of sauces. In fact, all of them, I think, are for the most part. I think they all are gluten-free. The pizza crust, there's six of them are gluten-free. But I never got around to doing much more with the wheat because that was not my favorite grain to use for this process. Oats. I do love using oats, rolled oats. Didn't get a chance to work with oat groats. And that's something that might make Volume 2 should this book do well enough to justify more work. And I do have several ideas. There's dessert recipes I want to do, a bunch of breakfast pizzas that didn't make it, a lot of raw foods recipes that just didn't have time to really complete the testing process to include in here. By the way, the book is self-published, which is something we may want to discuss a little bit later. Daniel, you there back from the kitchen?
Oh, yeah. I was getting myself my ginger tea. As we were just talking about ginger, I was just boiling up some fresh ginger tea.
Ah, that's why your ears were burning.
That's. But honestly, I want to, for people just joining us, and we do have some listeners here. I see some folks in the chat room, and that doesn't mean that that's all that's listening, but people that are officially members, you see them in the chat room.
Okay.
So,
well, ask questions. God
sure.
Damn it.
Yeah.
Hey, can I swear? Am I bleeped out?
It's rated E for everyone, but we can always change that. And Brett, we kind of just naturally don't swear that much. So.
It's okay.
But, yeah, you can actually, I can just change the rating.
I can't fault you for that.
But for people just joining us, we did try a piece of this pizza, or I did for the first time. It was actually quite good. I was highly impressed by the texture of the sauce being very cheese-like, and you did not think that you were eating a product that was no fat, no oil, no cheese. Well, it might not have been cheese, but it really had that full, thick, satisfying texture as advertised in conversation and in the book, this particular one did.
Yeah, to summarize real quickly, without going into great detail as we did earlier, the sauce, the topping sauce, I used the word topping. It could, some people, when I started this out, I found out from some of the cookbook authors I talked to, some people like their cheese on the bottom, some like it on top. So I ended up dividing things into arbitrarily into topping sauces and bottom sauces. For the convenience, I'm calling these topping sauces, but they could go on the bottom or in the middle or on both. I wouldn't put them under the crust, so I think that would be problematic. But this particular topping sauce had oats, cannelloni beans in it, sriracha sauce, which is a chili garlic sauce, and some a small amount of cashew nuts to give it a little bit of a kick. And the cannelloni beans, which is basically white kidney beans, give it a real nice velvet, whereas the oats act as more of a thickener. And, yeah, that was calculated.
And we've talked physically about the food for a while, and we'll do that again as it comes back. And now what I want to get into, and again, with our statement, none of this is to be preachy towards people about a vegan or vegetarian diet. What this is putting information out there according to what has definitely worked for Mr. Sutton and for many, many other people. And there is some fascinating information and studies out there that you can trace and look up, and we'll get into some of that. What I'd first like to start off are the four aspects that you mentioned in your book. You mentioned four reasons why many come to a vegan diet or perhaps a vegetarian diet.
Yeah, it tends to be a combination, if not one, or more of these four reasons to go vegetarian or vegan. I am biased having being a vegan, but the general reasons are, one, from an environmental standpoint, the amount of environmental devastation being affected by factory farming of our animals and in animal-based products. I hate to call these products our animals, is just incredible. The amount of manure, say, out of hog farms in North Carolina means you can't swim in the bay without warning signs. The amount of methane being put out by cows has become well known through the UN in various studies. So there's an environmental aspect, and I'm summarizing these. I could riff on any of these for an hour. The environmental aspects attract a lot of people to a vegetarian vegan diet.
Mm-hmm.
There's the animal rights or animal issues argument that they are sentient in the sense that they have emotions, that they have biographies, that they we have no right to eat another living being. That tends to be the most controversial, by the way. PETA has been good and been bad, if you want to look at it that way, in terms of
PR.
Yeah, and marketing the concept of this. But people who raise animals oftentimes realize that they do have emotions. I caretake a property that has chickens, and they have emotions. I have no doubt about it. They have emotions. They don't have a sense of humor, but they do have emotions. So I'm absolutely convinced of that. And so then it raises the issue of, do you eat something that has emotions? I mean, what right do we have? And that gets to be a very volatile issue on par with discussing religion and politics. A third issue, which was predominantly mine now, although I started out with more of a spiritual, I'll get to that, is health. There are more than enough studies, especially in the past decade because of our compute power and computer models, that show we can study a lot more people, that show that a vegetarian or vegan diet is much, much healthier and decreases your risk of degenerative diseases than anything else you can do, your lifestyle. Carlo Esselstyn put it best, heart disease as an example is a foodborne disease. Vegetarians, I just read a study this week that says vegetarians average 40 pounds lighter than the average American according to body mass index. So there are quite a few health aspects which I could easily talk about for a long period of time to consider avoiding eating meat and dairy and eggs. Then there's a spiritual reason for some people. They feel that meat imparts a lower vibration or a negative energy or a negative karma upon the individual who consumes it. That's not something that I really intend to go into in great detail, but that is one aspect that attracts people to a vegetarian or vegan diet. Did that cover it, Daniel?
Yeah. I was having one of our chat room listeners. I'd like to say hi to the chat room real quick because you mentioned questions. And one of them brought up the point.
Single and male.
I'm not sure if that's what she was bringing up.
5'9", hazel eyes.
5'9", and he's got long hair, this guy, and a little bit of a beard, not like a too gruffly beard. But there's the question of, well, aren't plants alive as well, is the one that the chat room asked.
That's one of those questions that people like to bring up as though it's a reason to not eat meat. You don't eat plants, you don't eat meat, you don't live. So to me the question becomes, is there a distinction between animals and plants? Last I checked, when I leave water out for my plants and say take care of yourself, they don't do very well. So, but mobility doesn't mean they're not alive. I believe plants are alive. I don't believe they feel pain. That's debated by some people. To me, it's a red herring, no pun intended. It's just something that is not a reason to eat meat, because plants can be considered alive. A spiritual person might want to bless the plant or bless the food before they eat it and say thanks, because you have given me your life. I consider plants highly evolved in that they live off of sunlight. And having worked an organic farm for 6 years on my own and actually worked on one professionally for a year, I have a great respect for the vegetable kingdom, and it's remarkably resilient. But I have no nightmares or ill feelings about eating a great plate of steamed chard or munching on some fresh corn from the field. So, yes, they're alive. You're also killing bacteria in your stomach all the time. In fact, recent studies said that we are composed of about 10,000 species of bacteria, okay,
mm-hmm.
Which means there are little organisms that are emerging and croaking in our bodies on a ongoing basis, and where you draw the line on what's alive and what's not alive versus diet is really an individual decision. For me, if it has eyes, if it has children, if it has a biography, to quote the philosopher Dr. Tom Reagan, a book is called Empty Cages, a really fantastic book, I'm not going to eat it.
Okay. I would like to mention as well.
Oh, we should mention the website at least.
Of course. We're going to do a plug right now. For those people who are listening, and we have some listeners out there right now, it's Heart Healthy Pizza. The author's name is Mark Sutton. The book is out, right? Self-published book that
right.
will get to you upon order. So if you can order it now physically. I actually have one physically here that I'm on my little music stand here, and it's got a nice picture.
At the website, hearthealthypizza.com, you can read the foreword by Mad Cowboy Howard Lyman. The introduction's there. There are sample recipes, endorsements from various nutritionists. And you'll find reviews, access to reviews, and hopefully a growing list of links to interviews.
And so once again.
And yes, you can order the book there.
Yeah,
in a couple different ways. You can also order an autographed copy, which I'd be more than glad to provide.
Awesome. Being an autographed copy as well, and since it's a new beginning thing.
By the way, we haven't mentioned it, but this is the very first vegan pizza cookbook. Never been done before.
That very specific.
Which is kind of cool when you think about it, I think.
Yeah. So we could be at the beginning of something, and if the foodies really catch on to this, this could really be very big for you.
I doubt that we're going to see it on Iron Chef, but, you know.
But you know how it is. People.
But Tali, make that pie vegan.
but the people in that, you're right, but the people in that world, in the foodie world, sometimes they like to get, you can get a nice cult following of something unique and interesting and special, and that's your own. And so it's www.hearthealthypizza.com, all one big word.
Yeah, I think people tend to be skeptical when I tell them it's vegan pizza. they blank out. Some people come back at me about 2 minutes later in a store. I'm talking about stuff like this. They go, wait a minute, how do you do the cheese?
Yeah.
So I think there's a skepticism involved in that, can you really pull this off? And then, you know, eventually we'll get to the issue of why no oil and no fat. But I'm curious to see if there's any more questions from the chat room. You guys chatting around there?
Oh, sure. A little bit, yeah. There's.
I love questions. Ask me questions, please.
She mentioned one of our listeners, the same one, mentioned something about, and with a little smiley face with its tongue sticking out, saying, well, plants, don't they procreate as well? So there's a little bit back to the plant and food argument.
Yeah, but if you eat their seeds, are you eating eggs? I would tend to be skeptical of that, but you can carry this to an extreme, and it's fun to think about, though. It doesn't
hurt. I think we've had this for now. And
I call myself a vegan, and some people say, well, you're not a vegan because, you know, it's a lifestyle, and there's a debate in the community about that. But I tend to be practical. I will kill a mosquito or a tick, and. Some vegans will say, you know, that's wrong, it's a life form, and they suck blood. What part of sucking blood do you not understand? So, you know, we draw our own lines, and we call ourselves what we want to call ourselves. I remember when I first decided to go vegan, I asked Howard Lyman, a.k.a. the Mad Cowboy, the guy who got sued with Oprah Winfrey. I'm his webmaster and special projects guy. I asked him, can I call myself a vegan? And Howard, in this classic style, said, you can call yourself whatever you want to call yourself. So, you know, the bottom line is, you know, you define it the way you want to define it. There's no certification, you know, process involved.
And I think tonight, for the purposes of this show and this conversation, I think we've kind of debated that enough, and everybody's gotten their corner and knows what their corner is. She says she's not giving up steak, never, and she put it in capital letters. So, but she's still listening, and we appreciate that, and she's a regular listener to our show. That's Marcy. Hello, Marcy. And, of course, Kevin Baird is there listening tonight, too. I will say this. There are rules, like my brother's wife has the rule of if it walks, flies, and swims. And, if it, like you said, if it has eyes, looks back up, it communicates back to you with a vocalization, then she won't eat it. Now, she's vegetarian, not vegan. But let's move on now from that argument. I think everybody's satisfied their thing as far as for the purposes of moving on. And let's go on now to the oil issue, a little bit away from
Let's go from controversy to real controversy here.
So I'm feeling spicy. Let's go.
Yeah, this is one that is a battle even within the vegan community itself. And do you want me to just take it from there, Daniel? Because
Dr. Caldwell Esselstyn and all of that.
Let me rattle off some statistics first.
Okay.
And then we'll get to the issue here. These are on heart disease. The leading cause of death in this country is heart disease. About 26% of our population dies of heart disease-related issues every year. In the United States, we have a person die of a heart attack, 52 people every minute. Okay, that's 52 people die of a heart attack in this country every minute. Almost 500,000 people a year die of just heart attacks in this country. According to the UN, right now about 30% of, this is in 2008, about 30% of the Earth's population had heart disease. Died of heart disease. That's about 17 million people. And in 2023, they're estimating we're going to lose around 24 million people from heart disease. Heart disease is the single biggest killer of people in this country. The cost to our healthcare system and loss of productivity in this country ranges around, depending on who you talk to, $300 to $400 billion a year.
Thanks.
Now, heart disease is a foodborne disease, according to Dr. Caldwell Esselstyn. Why did I go no oil vegan? Dr. Esselstyn is a surgeon from the Cleveland Clinic who was given a bunch of, I'm paraphrasing this terribly, a bunch of people who had very severe heart disease, and he put them on a no-added oil, we can get into why in a little bit, plant-based diet, code word vegan. And he actually, over time, their heart disease reversed. And that's something only one other person that we know of has successfully done on an active basis. That's Dr. Dean Ornish on the West Coast, and he did it the same way.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got 20-some plus years of peer-reviewed research by these two guys where they have done something modern medicine cannot do, that is reverse heart disease and, in theory, prevent it by a no-added oil, no-fat, vegan or plant-based diet. You get plenty of fat from regular food products if you're eating right. It's not a big deal. I interviewed Dr. Esselstein for his book, Prevent and Reduce Heart Disease. It's a fantastic read. It's well documented. A lot of good recipes in there. And after interviewing him, I asked him about this, and he said, well, you have a taste addiction to fat. If you give up oil and added fat for 13, 15 weeks or so, you lose your addiction to it. And so I decided, like everything else I do, to be empirical and actually give it a try. I gave up oil, and within about three months, I no longer craved it. I no longer craved oil and garlic and pasta. It's the least of my concerns. I don't crave fat. I do not have the taste addiction that most people have in this country to fat, as well as sugar and salt, but that's not what we're going to be talking about. So after interviewing Dr. Esselstein, I realized I needed to rethink my recipes that I had been working on for the book and make them no oil. And then I realized I could call the book Heart Healthy Pizza because it is indeed heart healthy. Dr. Esselstein has endorsed the book. Dr. Neil Barnard of the PCRM has called it a breakthrough, which I'm really proud of. Heart disease, obesity, diabetes, these are all things that many consider to be part of the same disease called metabolic syndrome, which can be reversed through proper diet, which means no meat, no dairy, no added oil in the case of heart disease. And there's other reasons on the no oil, which we may get into in a while, but that's the thumbnail sketch of no oil. And it's not that difficult to do. But like any addiction, you have to have a reason. You have to have determination. You have to do it. And no moderation. I mean, how many heroin users give up heroin and in the process, well, I'll just have a little today. No, if you're going to give up oil, you got to give up oil and give up oil and give up oil. And it's controversial because of the Mediterranean study predominantly, where people think, well, hey, you know, that reduced heart disease. Well, I asked Dr. Esselstein about this in my interview, which I linked to on my website. He says that the Mediterranean diet just reduced the amount of heart disease. It did not obliterate it, as he wants to. Several people still died of heart disease. So it was not a panacea. It's you know, added oil. Oil is not a food. Let me, Dan, can I get in that a little bit?
Please.
Oil is not a food. It's not a real food. I haven't seen an oil pool in nature yet. I'm looking.
And you're talking about, I wanted to clarify, by the way, real quick, and then you jump right back
sure.
in. For anybody that, as we get talking, if that point wasn't driven home, he was saying no oil, including, because I saw one comment in the chat room about animal oil. He's talking about various oils like olive oil,
canola oil. There's many reasons.
Cutting out all of these can actually, according to Dr. Caldwell Esselstein.
Esselstein,
Stein. And he says he can reverse heart disease with a specific diet that he created, a plant-based diet.
And you can, in effect, in theory, prevent heart disease.
Prevent and
let me,
reverse.
Let
go
me,
ahead. But go, continue.
I lost my train of thought on that. First of all, Dr. Vogel at University of Maryland has measured the impact of olive oil and fatty foods on the blood vessels of the human body when you eat them. It constricts your blood vessels. This is a measurement. This is not a theory. This is not a guess, it's a measured fact. So over time, you keep constricting for 6 to 8 hours, I think it is, your blood vessels, and then they return to normal. You are affecting elasticity of your circulatory system, and you're increasing your risk of heart-related diseases. And it's very serious. Now let's get back to what I said about not finding an olive pool. Olive oil is not a real food. To quote Dr. Esselstein's son, a vegan firefighter, it's processed goo. It's a highly processed substance. I was wondering about how many olives go into making one tablespoon of olive oil. I did some research, and depending upon the size of the olives, it takes about 40 olives to make one tablespoon of olive oil. And what do you get? Well, with that one tablespoon of olive oil, you get around 14 grams of fat, which is excessive. You get 120 useless nutritionless calories, and you lose any fiber or minerals that are in the olive that helps mitigate the impact of that oil. How many people would make a stir fry with 40 olives as opposed to one tablespoon of olive oil? I just don't think that would work. So the issue of no added oil is controversial. A lot of people just can't wrap their cerebrums around the concept, which doesn't surprise me. I'm not trying to be insulting, but it took a leap of faith to try it for me. Did the research, realize that oil also helps create free radicals in the body, which is bad. It's just not a food. And we've got to get past this notion that it is a food, because it's not, and it's not healthy, and that's what I believe. And I can't prove it, but it's what I do believe. And I've had nutritionists, I've had a couple registered dietitians take me on online. And I tell them at some point, if they get particularly vociferous and mean, you know, when you can successfully do what nobody else has done but these two guys, and that's reverse heart disease, get back to me, and I'll be glad to pay attention. I asked Dr. Esselstyn at one time, I think this was in personal conversation, about why conventional surgeons and people who deal with heart disease patients don't pay attention to what his research. And he says, there's usually two reasons. One is subtle. They make a lot of money treating people the way they do. And they don't cure heart disease. They just help you live a little longer, okay? It's not cured. They don't cure heart disease, okay, with a stent or with statin drugs. You're not cured. You just live a little longer. Secondly, they say that people would never take to such a draconian diet. And I have to laugh at that, too, because I have such a rich, rich variety of foods and a wonderful diet. I'm so happy with it. And so are most vegans. But Dean Ornish and Esselstyn both say, you know, what's more draconian, cutting open a person's chest and shoving in a pig vessel to try to repair a heart versus a healthy dietary lifestyle? I have to go with the healthy dietary lifestyle as my choice for extending my life and avoiding the problems of heart disease. Did I proselytize enough there, Dan?
I'm responding okay. To the chat room a little bit, something I often don't do a lot because a lot of times I walk around. So we have some people chatting back and forth.
Are there any questions? Like, who is this guy? I mean,
just some more comments about...
I'll never give up meat. We get that a lot, and people like pronounce the never give up meat. And, you know, that's your prerogative. I mean, you do what you want.
And I also commented saying, no, it was very good. It was very tasty, and... You know, I'm from Baltimore, and I say from mid-country up, they do pizza well. So I know what pizza is and supposed to taste like. When I lived down south for a while, no offense to our southern listeners, the town I was in, it was tough to find a really good. You know, if you're in New York, Chicago, Maryland, you can get some great sub shops and pizza shops.
Oh, I've worked a couple.
And you go up northeast, you get great stuff. And I was in the Panhandle in Florida, in Pensacola. Now, I will say Panhandle does fish very well. They do awesome, you know, red snappers and groupers and all that. If you're eating, of course, I know you don't eat fish. But there's certain things they do great down south, pizza.
Oh, my father
was not one of them.
My father used to take me fishing for red snapper, and we'd grill it when we got home. It was fantastic. And
yeah.
I've worked a couple pizza parlors. I had the best catfish I ever had when I ate fish. Was in Texas, fried in cornmeal. Fantastic.
Oh, they have this great hard fried.
Oh, yeah. Well,
do.
Listen, country fried steak is, well, caloric nightmare, but it's got to be seen to be believed. People who batter dip steak and then fry it, for God's sake. And then no, let's add mashed potatoes and gravy. You know, you wonder,
on top of it.
You wonder what they're smoking. But
bacon, too. I've seen deep fried bacon.
Yeah. But I've worked a couple pizza parlors. I gained a lot of weight once on on, what's the pizza chain? Big deep dish, Uno's. I mentioned it. Uno's unfortunately opened a parlor close to where I used to live in Dallas, Texas, and I gained a lot of weight. But God, I loved their pizzas. They were fantastic. And so I've always had, like most people, this love of pizza. And giving up cheese was tough. For a while, I went with the fake cheeses. They were terrible. The current generation is amazing, as I mentioned.
They've gotten better.
Back when I started out, they were like rubber.
Plastic.
And I got by without. I grilled vegetables and have roasted vegetables on top of my pizzas and was pretty happy with that. But I wondered if it could be done. It's been done. And I have served my pizza to carnivores before, largely family members who were tied down to the table and forced to eat pizza. And it was very encouraging when unilaterally they said they really liked what I made. Although I made one that was way overkill for my parents, I tried to put too much on it and blew it, but I learned better. And pizza is wonderful in that you can make mistakes, learn from them. The leftovers, I mean, even if you mess up a pizza, you can still eat it.
Yeah.
But you'll find that...
One of our chat room people mentioned that too as well.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun, and it's so cheap and easy. I mean, I love bread machines and Trader Joe's pre-made dough, and I'm not being paid by Trader Joe's for that, but it's easy. And bread machines, fantastic, because you can prep a pizza in about 15 minutes. The ingredients in the bread machine, let it crank for 45 minutes to an hour and a half, work on your toppings or your sauce at that time, pull out the dough, shape it, throw it on top, put it in the oven for 15, 20 minutes, and you've got yourself a pizza. And you're spending a couple bucks for a pizza, for God's sakes. And people order these $15 nightmares from Domino's and Godfather's and whomever else, and yet... In the time it takes them to decide what they want to order and get the order and pay for it, they could practically have made a very healthy pizza with or without cheese on it themselves. Mm-hmm. So to me, there's nothing like a homemade pizza crust. I mean, it's incredible. What I don't have is a brick oven in the kitchen, but you can make do without that.
Yeah.
Also, grilling pizza is fantastic. That's something I didn't get into in this book, where you grill your pizza dough, and a little bit of char admittedly is not as healthy as it could be, but I'm not charring meat, which has a whole host of interesting chemicals being created in that process. The little charred bread on a pizza is just fantastic. Gives a real nice taste to it. Anything from the chat room? Any questions?
Not so much questions, just little statements coming in and out. There was some mentioning about how some places... And this is a good one, and Marcy brought this one up. She mentioned the price of produce sometimes. And when you're talking about produce, and you could equate that into talking about vegan diet, and that sometimes these places are really expensive, like you go to maybe Whole Foods or other places. Now, Trader Joe's is a little cheaper. That's where I work, and I get a discount, right? And I go to farmers markets, and I go there. In your case, you grow things. We grow things here on the property, too.
Yeah, I have a thousand square foot vegetable garden in southern Pennsylvania. But let me talk about the cost of produce, because it's something I didn't realize until I worked. I was on two satellite missions at NASA. When I quit working at NASA, I worked on an organic farm for a year. And I began to realize something that a lot of people don't pick up on. There's a seasonal nature to produce. Now, I don't always eat organic. I love farmers markets. I love local produce. I'll take local over expensive organic every time, just because I think it's probably healthier. Organic local is the best. But there's a seasonal nature to produce that a lot of people just aren't aware of. You try to buy tomatoes right now in the northern latitudes, and you're going to pay an arm and a leg because they're just not being harvested. They're probably going to start harvesting in July, late July. There's a seasonal nature to produce, and people don't realize that. In the winter, you're getting produce largely from Chile and from the south and from South America or from China. China's become very big in some relatively conventional produce. And so you have to look at the seasonal nature of the produce you're purchasing. Was it shipped clear across country? Organic is nice, but organic can be very expensive. I recently went to the Fairfax, Virginia farmer's market for the first time. Prices were a bit high, but then again, I grow a lot of what they're selling myself.
Yeah.
And this is a higher rent district, so there's nothing wrong with it's not unexpected that the prices would be a bit higher. I recommend growing your own, and I'm talking about legal produce.
Yeah.
It's easy. You can, even with an apartment, you don't need a whole lot of area to grow plants in pots. I started out growing conventional herbs in pots. There's no reason not to have a little garden of herbs. You can get specialized small tomatoes. You can grow zucchini. Lettuces, kale, chard grow like crazy. They're hard not to grow. I think everybody should have a small garden. Back in World War II, we had what's called victory gardens, where the government actually subsidized people to have their own gardens, which certainly wouldn't happen now, even with the Farm Bill going through Congress, because corporations want us to be dependent upon them for their money and their products. But growing your own food, it's so easy. Start with kale, chard, and lettuces. Zucchini, there's an old joke in the South about zucchini, that when you go to church in the summer, you make sure you lock your doors and your trunk because you'll find zucchini in it when you get out of church.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people, it's prolific.
Yeah.
It just grows like crazy. But growing your own produce is the ultimate solution. Other than that, try to buy seasonal. And the high-end stores, Whole Foods is good for some things. Trader Joe's is good for some things. Disclaimer, I met Daniel at Trader Joe's
Yes, that's true.
I was working on the book last summer here. And, you know, just be a sharp shopper. Also, buying highly processed foods is more expensive than buying the whole food. And people think, well, it's going to take too much time. I love my crock pot. I love roasting vegetables. Make enough for two or three days. One of the tricks I use in salads, which I teach people, or guide people, or tell people about, is when you make a salad and prep toppings for your salad, say fresh vegetables and the like, prep enough lettuce for 3 or 4 days so that you don't get caught into the trap of thinking it's going to take too long to make a salad. No, it doesn't. You just got to plan a little bit. But produce can be expensive. Usually it's a seasonal thing, or it's an organic thing, or it's a rare vegetable. I was surprised when I saw my first star fruit going for $10 a pound in Dallas, Texas, when I used to be, we had star fruit trees on campus at the University of Florida.
Right, right.
So it's
pick them up. Like avocados around here sometimes, right? If you grew up in California, you're just picking them up, you know, all the time, right?
Oh, yeah.
Depending on where you are. I wanted to get to some things real quick, and then we'll continue our conversation. And that is, I'll do a few plugs. First of all, I saw in the chat room as well, and I'd like to say hi to everybody there, Marcy and guest 8640 and Kevin Baird. And Kevin Baird is my co-host.
You mean the 8640?
That's right, 8640.
My God, I haven't heard about it. I haven't heard from him, her in a long time.
Him, her. But Kevin can be found. He's my co-host, and he's listening actually right now. And he can be found at www.templeofgaia.com. He's an intuitive consultant, psychic medium, and does readings. He as well is an artist and creates Gaia Gardens and Paranormal Windows. And you can find him and information about him at www.templeofgaia.com. In fact, this is his deck here that he created, Mark. It's the Horizon Oracle. It's on the table. And his workbook has been published out for now, and I liked what it was called. It was called The Book of Possibilities, and I thought his little workbook, I thought that was a nice title. And he hosts a show on our network called Walking on the Sidewalk.
That's kind of fun. The Gaia Hypothesis had a major impact on my life and my thinking and my own research when I was at NASA, believe it or not. But it's something I couldn't talk about conventionally because it's still considered a bit radical in some circles, although it's getting better.
I think he said clone. I'm not sure if he was. I don't know if he was referring to the person with the number for a name or something like that. But that would be kind of funny if it was. But we think you're a real person, guest, and we're glad that you're here listening to Main Street Universe on a special Sunday.
Well, it might have been 8639 I was talking to instead of 8640.
That's right. It was someone entirely different.
Yeah.
But let us also get to our other co-host, Brett Hillman, our Eye in the Sky reporter. He's our astrologer for our main Wednesday show, and he does a little Eye in the Sky report. He won't be joining us for a few weeks as he's going to school, but I wanted to plug his show. It's on a network called Pagans Tonight. And on Pagans Tonight, it's actually this evening after this show is over. You can go to Pagans Tonight. The show is called Back to Basics, and it's a Back to Basics metaphysical show.
So you can go from vegan to pagan, which is a two-letter difference.
That's right. It's just a slight shift in lettering in the beginning there. So I wanted to plug this couple of things, and that'll be his show starts at 9 o'clock Eastern time on the Pagans Tonight radio network called Back to Basics with his host, S. Danielle Young is his co-hostess. So, back to vegan pizza. And guess what, Mark? There is exactly 24 minutes and 24 seconds left as I was reading that. 2424. And which is an interesting number to pick right away, because that breaks down to 6 plus 6 is 12, 3. So that's working with the public, and things involve projects with the public. So,
well, I can riff on something that I could get into here.
Sure.
Yeah, one of the things that was interesting to me was statistics. I love statistics and math, and I did some research in the process of doing this book and also doing research, checking out, you know, what Dr. Esselstyn had to say. And one of the things I found out is the American Heart Association has some interesting viewpoints on sugar, salt, and fat, which are the three unholies, if you will, in our diet. It's what our food companies addict us to. As an example, again, we're talking fat, sugar, and salt. There are a lot of food products that are marketed in Britain that have less salt and sugar in them and fat than they do in our country because of what our people want and the fact that the UK has a Medicare system, so the government wants to spend less money so that they have higher restrictions on what can be in food products. But here's the deal. The American Heart Association recommends no more than around the equivalent of 9 teaspoons of sugar a day for the adult male. Okay. Now, what's interesting is that works out to roughly the amount of sugar in one very large soda. So this is one of the reasons Bloomberg came out with his recent proclamation against very, very large sodas in New York. They're killing people, and this has been measured. The government the American Heart Association recommends around 1,500 milligrams, that's 1.5 grams of salt per day per person. That's between one-half and three-fourths teaspoons. Yet the average American male eats 10 times that amount of salt on a daily basis. Probably not good for your system.
Mm.
Now the fat. American Heart Association recommends around 50 to 70 grams of fat per day. If you don't know what that is, you need to start reading labels. At least that's what I recommend. And that's something I will recommend is you read labels and understand fat, sugar, and salt, or sodium, if you will, in terms of salt. Now, the American Heart Association recommends 50 to 70 grams of fat per day. Dr. Esselstyn and Dr. Ornish recommend anywhere from 15 to roughly 25 grams of fat per day. Now, the amount of fat in one tablespoon of olive oil is 14 grams, which is pretty close to 15 or the bottom end of that range. So you can see there's some disparities there. So the way I look at it is if you exceed the American Heart Association's recommendations, you're really messing up because I consider them very conservative, okay? And I've told people if you disagree with the American Heart Association, you're really on very thin ice, okay? The fact that one-half teaspoon of three-fourths teaspoon of salt per day frightens people. They go, that's unbelievable. It really is. And the amount of sugar we consume, the amount of fat we consume, this is how we are killing ourselves. This is how why one-third of our country is clinically very obese. And our children are showing signs of heart disease and type 2 diabetes was rare 30, 50 years ago. Now it's become very common. It is a foodborne disease, just like heart disease is. And again, I'm on my soapbox now. I apologize, but the caffeine's kicking in. Yes, I do caffeine. I do some things that aren't really great for me, but, you know, I'm not perfect yet. So it's something to consider. When you buy a product that has a label on it, pay attention to calories, sure, but I think, in my mind, the percentage of fat per calories, the amount of fat, the amount of sodium, and the amount of sugar are very important. I watched a man who had a heart attack, somebody I knew very, very well, go to McDonald's and order a chicken sandwich, and I sent him an email that night saying, you realize that you had over a day's worth of salt in that one sandwich, and yet you recently had a heart attack? He had no idea. And so, if nothing else, don't believe me. Read the labels. Do some research. Get online. One of the beauties of the Internet over the past 15, 20 years is wackos like me who don't want to eat meat can research these things. We can find out what's going on in terms of nutrition. You can explore what's in our foods, which has also been a revelation to a lot of people. This pink slime thing is not a big deal to a lot of us vegetarians and vegans. We knew there's a bunch of junk in most of our conventional meat products for the past couple of decades.
And there is some truth here going on. There's some middle ground, and there's some truth, and there's stuff in the chat room, of course, from the meat eaters there. But there is some things that they actually agree with you on.
Uh-oh.
And that is...
I didn't mean it.
Is the processed food thing. I mean, that's one place where there's common ground, I think. We'll see in a second, I guess. But there's this idea, like Marcy mentioned earlier, she hears the cows that she's going to eat later. They're local, and they're a few miles away. Whereas there is something where I think that people can find some common ground on, and that issue is, and we might make it the issue of some other show at some other time, of things that the food industry has gotten away with. You know, things like just silly, weird stuff that the food industry does. I'm saying silly and weird, but some of it's actually pretty tragic. Of the processing things, of doing really odd things to food, even on a small level that's not necessarily dangerous, but it's just not tasty. Like, for example, a lot of tomatoes you buy in a supermarket, they pick them green, and it's like, that's why they don't taste like anything. It's so ridiculous. That's why when you grow one, it tastes 100 times better. Because now, that's not the case for everybody. I'm just saying that's one trick they do. They actually treat it with a gas to green it.
Actually, several products, including bananas, are notorious for that, too.
Yeah. But away from that just a little bit, I also wanted to say, when you've been mentioning Caldwell Esselstein, his son, Rip Esselstein, the fireman you mentioned earlier,
yeah.
His diet, if people want to look it up, is called...
The Engine 2 diet. Let me riff on Rip.
Okay.
Pun intended. Rip Esselstein is a firefighter who's vegan out of Austin, Texas. He became vegan after his father's research, or plant-based, if you will, and he wrote a book called The Engine 2 Diet because the number one cause of death among firefighters is not fire, it's heart disease, which is a shock when I found that out recently. And he had noticed how fat a lot of people he was saving are, that they had problems getting them out of the buildings that were on fire. And also that his team had high cholesterol levels, were very overweight, had signs of heart disease. And he actually put them on a revised diet, and their numbers their numbers were fantastic. The doctors were amazed at how healthy they became and how well they did. So he wrote this fantastic book. He's I think he was an Olympic athlete, but he did a lot of major athletics, coaches Lance Armstrong. And he put his exercise routine, his dietary recommendations, and recipes from his mother, Ann Esselstein, into his book, The Engine 2 Diet. And what's been wonderful about Rip is here is the paragon of American heroism, probably even more so than those who serve us in our battles, a firefighter, a volunteer firefighter who is a plant-based. He calls it plant strong.
Okay.
He says he's plant strong, and he travels around the country and lectures. They've got a very active website, Engine 2, diet or engine2.org. Web search, of course, will get you there very easily. And it's fantastic that he's out. Not, I wouldn't say he's pushing it. He's just saying, this is what I do. This is what I found. Look at me. He's strong. He's healthy. He's active. And he's got quite a following. So Rip has basically taken his father's research and helped popularize that research and make it more accessible to the average individual.
Mm-hmm. And that's interesting. And this guy's very, you know, to see him, he's very fit. He's a very in-shape-looking guy. So when people think vegan, they go, oh, there's some sickly-looking, you know. And this guy's really in shape, healthy, you know, kind of looks like the model of fitness.
I used to love it when I was younger telling people that gorillas are vegans. Or at least then I'd say vegetarian, but they're vegan.
Yeah.
And they effectively are. Now, they may eat some insects once in a while, but they're essentially vegan. But Rip's a good example of how to do it right, as far as I'm concerned.
All right. And coming down, we've got about 15 minutes left here. And let's go back now. We've talked
I've written a few songs. No, I'm
there you
sorry.
Go. we used to do live music here.
No,
we still do sometimes on Main Street Unit. I used to start the show playing my guitar there on the floor and doing a riff and then sometimes singing a song. But let's go back now. We've covered a little
bit.
Again,
we're talking pizza.
Yeah, we're talking pizza. Let's get back to now. We've talked a little bit of philosophy. We started it off. I said we're going to bookend this with starting off with just the food itself, then a little bit into the philosophy and what it means to be vegan and ups, downs, a little bit of politics, not too much. And now let's get right back to the food again for a little bit and mention a couple more recipes, talk about them, and then maybe, if there's time left over, a very, very, very brief reading, meaning either the Tarot or the Oracle there in front of you, if you're comfortable with that sort of thing.
I will help you make a pizza in your mind.
If you knew my lifestyle in the 20s, my mind might already be pizza.
I see you now shaping the dough. It's a good dough.
I'm glad there's a little dough up there and still to shape. That's you got to look at the positives. Or as Sam Kinison, was it him? One of those comedians, Rodney Dangerfield or somebody, used to say, one brain cell holding up the other going, think, think.
Oh, I like that.
But I've been good. I'm good right now.
Oh, I lost my brain cell a long time ago. Go ahead.
You lost it, singular? But anyway, here's another one. There was one I definitely wanted to comment on because something that I love and is near and dear to my heart is you had a curry one that sounded a little bit interesting.
Oh, the Clever Curry Pizza.
Yes, yes.
Oh, yeah, I love Indian food.
Me
and I
too.
Think this one had cauliflower, peas, tomatoes, might have had coriander powder on it, definitely some cumin seeds. The book is divided into four sections.
Mm-hmm.
The first section is making your pizza foundation. In other words, making different types of crust, if you will. And again, some of them are gluten-free, some are not. The second section is what I call bottom sauces because they're conventionally on the bottom of a pizza, although more and more I just use sliced tomatoes on the bottom of a pizza. But these are sauces designed for the bottom. There's green, white, and red sauces and some brown sauces, which I like using the color motif.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, and the one we ate today was very, very aesthetic. You know, it was like a work of art underneath of the cheese sauce there. So
we're going to post some pictures of this, we hope.
Yeah, there's some already on, of some of yours already on our marquee for the show as well.
And then the third chapter is really the nugget of the book. That's all the recipes for the topping sauces. That's where they really, really kicks into high gear. Fourth chapter has two types of pizzas. There are those pizzas where I say, okay, you use a cup of this, a cup of this, a tablespoon of that, a tablespoon of this. And then there are some that are conceptual where, okay, now picture this in your mind. And I basically say, this is what's on this pizza, and this is how it's flavored. Because I find that when I make a pizza, I don't measure the toppings. Not for the sauce I do, okay, for the ingredients, because making the sauce is not a precise, but a recipe that should be followed to some degree. But in the film that I call the pizza fillings, you know, the broccoli, the onions, and the goodies you put inside, I don't measure those. I just take the pizza and then cut things up and place it on there the way I want them. Leftovers can go into soups or stews or on salads, any number of things and sauces. And creativity is maintained. So, again, there are two types of pizzas in that section. One where they're measured and one where they're just recommended. There's also some appendices, cooking grains. There's an appendice on, they're all very short, one on why no oil, for those who are curious. And there's one on why vegan. Okay, just basically laying out the reasons. Again, trying not to proselytize. And then there's one on just statistics on cheeses, the fake cheeses versus the real cheeses, so that people will know I'm not kidding in terms of their fat content.
And
also a very complete glossary of ingredients that describe what these ingredients are and where to get them. That I think will be useful. There's also a resource section, online and offline resources for information on anything that I've talked about in the book, as well as places to go and buy certain products. I think it's a one-stop shop to learn how to make a really good pizza and make that pizza healthy, heart-healthy, and the most nutritious pizza you possibly can.
Yes, and I wanted to mention, because I saw a new listener occasionally, or they're coming in and out and back in, is a book about, it's called Heart Healthy Pizza. Go to www.hearthealthypizza.com, all one big word, and it is a vegan pizza. That means no cheese, and in his case, no added oils, which might make his a little more, Mark Sutton is his name, is a little more unique than other vegetarian books or something of that nature. And here's another recipe that just sounded awesome that I would love to try, and I love the mix
you
here.
You really did mark those up. Look at that.
Yeah, I got my markers here.
Are those drool spots?
These are, they're like, I don't know, some kind of ribbon or something.
No, it looks like drool stains here.
Oh, here's the one
okay. That
I like. It's sweet potato, oats, carrot, and green chili sauce. That sounds awesome.
Yeah, let me talk, because that was fun.
Yeah.
I deliberately set out to make this one. I was thinking, well, sweet potatoes are oranges. And one of the things I wanted to do was I wanted some of these recipes to have the color of a cheddar cheese or reminiscent of a cheddar cheese. You can always mess with the taste factors. That's easy with spices. And so I thought sweet potatoes. And then I started thinking corn. And basically this became a South American kind of motif, which was deliberate. I just thought it was a great sport to do something that was kind of an homage to South America. This one had oats in it. Another one did not. I think I had quinoa and sweet potato. I forget. But the sweet potato was kind of fun. Not all these recipes have grains in them. Not all have beans. Some are just strictly vegetables. But the goal was to find a way to incorporate sweet potatoes and not make it too overpowering in terms of the sweetness, which is why I had the green chili sauce and the green chilies in there, which tended to offset the sweetness of the potato. But the carrots and the sweet potato really give it a nice color. And really, the texture worked out really well. It's not as firm in terms of some of the other sauce toppings. By the way, one of the things I found out when I started making these recipes is leftover sauce can easily be used on pasta, on steamed vegetables, on grains. I've used them on quesadillas. I've used them in wraps. I've also thinned them out and used them as salad dressing. So I don't see these topping sauces as being just for pizzas. I think there are many things you can, the creative cook can do with them that add to what you can do in the kitchen.
Awesome. And we're coming down to about 6 minutes left here. I see we still got some listeners here in the chat room. And
no questions, callers. No questions.
Some call-ins, somebody mentioning sweet potatoes are delicious.
Vitamin A, sweet potatoes.
And I like that idea about how it fits in with the color of the cheddar cheese. Now, tell me when to stop. At any time, you can inform me when
stop.
To stop. Okay.
He's shuffling a deck.
I'll break it into three. And pick.
I used to do this trick with Gregor deck of cards.
Which one's first?
Middle one.
Middle one first. Okay. King of Swords.
Story of my life.
This is a general one.
The man's working the cards here.
And then this one. Okay. Here's what I'm getting from this. Hello, Goop. Thanks for joining us for the reading. Do you have an opinion on that card?
You heard it first.
In the middle, King of Swords, I get it can be very piercing and fierce in some ways. It's a sword.
Right.
However, the King of Swords is of air, so this is a card, I'm trying to be a little quick, of calm leadership. The one that comes after it is interesting because for progress in this project, I see you have to let go of some combat. There's some things in your way. This is a lot of combat. Reversed is actually good news. It means that perhaps maybe now finally things are going to start working out for you. What I had before that was this is the Knight of Swords, and that's a great action card, but it was reversed. Reversed meaning, again, something, some things really getting in the way and not letting this action happen. And these things can be of, it can be so many different things. And I know you, so I don't want to make it sound like I'm trying to force the read of anything I know that might have gotten in your way. But these are some things. That, this is an obstacle. Then you come to the present.
Well, certainly the injury I had was.
Yeah, and I knew that, and I wasn't trying to push that because I didn't
major,
want to
major impact
reading.
On things.
This though, this is you, and I know you. You can be a little bit. What I know of you.
Uh-oh.
This is a good card for you, the King of Swords, because you're a little bit like my brother and a little fiery, and you could use a little bit. You have a leadership type of personality. You could use the wisdom of a calm leader. Swords of air. See, he's high up and floating and see the clouds. Calm a little bit.
Like wow.
And let go of the combat, some of the combat, because it looks like, according to this reading, that things can start happening very positive for you. If it was this way, it would have been worse. It would have meant you're going to get mired in combat. But it being reversed, it can let some of this Five of Wands stalemate go. So to get rid of this stalemate, calm leadership, don't get too emotional. That's how I go with that reading. So it's letting go sometimes of the fiery emotion, the combat, and using calm air sign king type of leadership. So that's what that reading is for this project. We were sort of general about your project was what that reading
okay.
is for.
Well, I want to thank Daniel for his time and effort and trust. This is the first online live interview I've given in a long time.
Oh, okay.
And it's been great sport. He took a risk here, and it's a radical topic, and I really appreciate his time and efforts and his preparation for this.
Yes, absolutely. And I see also one more plug here will be Kevin Baird, www.templeofgaia.com. He has a show coming up on Friday. He does a Friday show with us. And it's called Walking on the Sidewalk. And that's what this other deck here is, too. It's a Horizon Oracle deck. And again, I picked up a card here. It's kind of similar. This is just talking about being calm and jumping over those obstacles and jumping over the negativity. And don't get too emotional. Don't get stuck in this stuff. You know, this is like...
It looks like oil to me.
It's like a planet broken up. And it's all about not getting stuck in this murky combat. You just got to leap over this mess. And that's one from his deck, known as the Jump card. Very quick reading. I know we're coming down in time here. Again, thank you. It's www.hearthealthypizza.com. Thank you very much, Mark Sutton.
Appreciate it, Daniel.
Good luck with your project. It was nice to do this. We're going to get out of here with Kelly Anna, who I did have permission from her personally to use her songs. And here we go. Thank you. Remember, the mysteries and possibilities of the universe are closer to Main Street than you may have ever imagined.
Things worldly that do not serve me. Mother, love me. Mother, help me. Mother, heal me. Please release me from all things worldly that do not serve me. Mother, love me.
When
Mother,
in these songs I feel
Mother,
the power,
me.
I am reborn as I break
from
these
all things
chains that bind. And now I'm floating light as a feather.
Mother, heal me.
Please break
from all things.